from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, for over a half century, Mountain View-based SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, has been scouring the heavens for signs of alien life. Because of cutbacks, SETI Institute has had to shut down its array of listening devices, the Allen Telescope array of dishes, ironically, just when the Kepler satellite has identified a number of planets that could have life on them. We'll discuss the future of SETI and the Allen Telescope array next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's second hour of the Forum program. The Allen Telescope Array, the enormous ear to outer space listening for intelligent life, located here in Northern California, has shut down, gone into hibernation. Jointly operated by SETI Institute and UC Berkeley, cutbacks have forced the shutdown of the telescope array, built to conduct high-resolution radio astronomy observations of cosmic events and objects, and to listen for radio broadcasts of any alien civilization that might be within hearing distance from the Earth. The shutdown has occurred just as the Kepler satellite has identified a number of planets similar to our own that could possibly have life on them. The nonprofit SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, was founded and launched in 1984 and has had as its mission exploring, understanding, and explaining the origin, nature, and prevalence of life in the universe. This Forum Hour, we discuss the ongoing search for intelligent life beyond the Earth and the future of SETI. Joining us in studio, Andrew Fracknoy, chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College and veteran of many broadcasts with us. Andy, good to have you back here. Welcome.
Nice to be back with you.
Tom Pearson is also with us for the first time. Glad to have him. He's CEO and co-founder of SETI Institute. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
Let me begin, if I may, with you, Tom. It's not, just to clear up a little bit of confusion, it's not SETI that we need to worry about. That program is ongoing. It's the array of telescopes as far as funding specifically.
Well, in terms of our SETI Institute, we have three centers, one of which is our Center for SETI Research. Another is our Carl Sagan Center for the Study of Life in the Universe, where we have a very large, successful, ongoing astrobiology program with over 50 senior scientists serving as principal investigators there. And we also have a significant education and public outreach program. So the answer is yes, our SETI data collection instrument, the Allen Telescope Array, is in financial trouble right now, but the rest of our institute's in quite good shape.
Paul Allen gave $30 million, didn't he?
He did. Paul was extraordinarily generous, and we'll be forever grateful for him in taking the risk as we and our partners at Berkeley invented a brand new instrument that has actually never existed before on planet Earth and will change the way that radio astronomy instruments are built forevermore, I think, into the future.
What do you say to those who say, well, there are no results, really?
I would say we've only just begun, and that answer is hard for some to comprehend since Dr. Frank Drake did the first SETI search in 1960, now almost 51 years since that search. But the truth is humankind's technology, our instrumentation, is only just now getting up to the task. Jill Tarter has an extremely clear way of explaining it. The amount of SETI searching that's happened to date, if you make that analogous to looking for fish in the ocean, the amount of radio space that we have explored is equivalent to dipping one glass of water out of all of the oceans of Earth, seeing no fish in that glass, and assuming that there must be no fish in the ocean.
But there are some things that we ought to highlight that have come out of this search, because you often hear, even though it's kind of a drop in the ocean compared to what we pay for defense and so forth, you often hear, what are really the results or what are really the productive things that have come out? And first of all, there's an algorithm that ought to be mentioned in conjunction with breast cancer research.
Well, that's correct. Back in the 90s, the SETI signal detection algorithms searching for very weak signals in the noisy background of deep space, those algorithms were applied by physicians in Florida at the University of South Florida to breast cancer detection techniques at that time. So that was one of the early spinoffs, if you will.
And there's also, the possibility of, and actually the reality of, finding space junk that can damage satellites and do some serious harm out there in stellar space.
Well, that's correct. The Allen Array is the first ever instrument of its type, and thus it provides a unique way to look at the sky. And one of the things that we have been doing with the U.S. Air Force for the last couple of years is exploring how our technology brings something new to the tracking and detailed position location of both orbiting debris and active satellites in space. The issue there is one that really affects all of humanity, because we have had a major collision up in space that created thousands and thousands of pieces of debris. There are roughly 100,000 total pieces of debris in orbital space, and if we get more collisions, it's estimated that some number of approximately a half dozen more collisions of significance in space, and we will begin to obliterate the usefulness of orbital space, both for manned spaceflight and for the satellites that our communications and our economy depends on. So we're proud that our invention of this telescope is a significant new way to look at that.
We're talking again with Tom Pearson, who is CEO and founder of SETI Institute. You need, as I guess the reckoning goes, about $1.5 million a year to put the Allen Array of telescopes back in operation, or to bring it back online?
Yes, there's two numbers involved. The number of $1.5 million that you mentioned is the operating cost that's required just to keep the observatory on the air, pay the staff, pay the utility bills, and have the array functioning. We add an approximate $1 million bill on top of that that we have to pay each year to support the costs of our SETI scientists who do the observations and data analysis.
So you're going to have some software to use the telescope to raise money, maybe?
We are. We're right now, donors who are interested in helping us with our cause can go to our website, read about the Kepler planets and the search we plan to do there. But we are also working with several Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who are specialists in the social networking arena to take advantage of the extraordinary interest that's come up in the last several weeks about our problem, and try to take advantage of social networking and crowdsourcing to build momentum for donors to help us out. And that's something we plan to announce in the coming weeks. We're working on the details of that software right now.
Again, Tom Pearson, CEO and co-founder of SETI Institute. Andrew Frocknight, most famous astronomer maybe extant in the Bay Area, and also chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College. And let's talk about what the Kepler planets that Tom Pearson alludes to here, because this is really, in many ways, the irony that these telescopes are closing down, and now we found more planets that could probably have life just like we know it.
Absolutely. So we have a mission in space, which is searching not just for planets. We've already been finding hundreds of planets around other stars. But this is a mission especially good for finding planets that are like the Earth, where, you know, it's even possible that there are other kinds of KQED listeners. So we are looking for planets that cross the face of their stars. So imagine for a second that you're looking at the sun and the Earth is orbiting the sun, and you can see the Earth from another star's vantage point crossing the face of the sun. It will make the sun a tiny bit darker. Now, you'd have to have awfully good measurements to be able to detect the darkening of the sun by the tiny Earth crossing it. But that's what the Kepler telescope can do. It can measure the dimming of a star to within 20 parts in a million.
How many have they identified? I mean, the galaxy I'm reading may have several hundred million habitable planets, but in terms of specific identification?
So far, this is only the first 4 months of looking. They've already identified 1,200 planet candidates, out of which several dozen are Earth-like. And some of these Earth-like ones are actually in Earth-like orbits. So they are in what we call the habitable zone, where it's warm enough and conditions are right for life as we know it. So just in the first 4 months, over 1,000 candidates have already been identified. And this is going to look for years. And we are very confident that there are going to be many more planets.
So, that's more candidates than the GOP has now.
That's right. And some of them may turn out to have more intelligent life. No, I shouldn't say that. But the exciting thing here is that these planets represent an amazing opportunity to target our search, to not just look randomly around the sky, but to find specific places where Jill Tarter and her team can concentrate the Allen Telescope Array. So that's why you're absolutely right. Just when the targets are springing up like daisies in spring, now the telescope has to be mothballed because of this California budget situation.
Well, let's talk about how those radio waves work. I mean, if they make contact, then someone out there, some force out there, some alien civilization, whatever, would be able to transmit back if they have that technology. But that's a big if. And then we have the language problems, of course. And didn't you make the analogy be like talking to an infant or something?
That's right. So first of all, we should say that we are not sending right now. We are only searching. We're hoping that among the civilizations out there are others who think like we do. And they will send out, they will realize as we do that by far the most efficient method of communication in outer space, as it is sometimes here on Earth, is radio. And that they will be sending some kind of message to us and that we can overhear. It may not be a message directed at us. It may be a message to one of their outposts. It may be a message that has a missionary role they just want to send to civilizations. But that we can overhear that message. Now, you're absolutely right. We don't speak alien and they probably don't speak English. But I like to give the analogy in my classes that when we're trying to make contact with aliens who don't speak our language, this is a problem every family faces when they have kids. You have this baby, and the baby doesn't speak English. How do you communicate with the baby? And, you know, we all figure it out. We show the baby pictures. We do it with gestures. We repeat things over and over again. And eventually, the baby learns language. Some of our teenagers way too much language, right? But we learn the language. And so that's what we hope to do with the communications, that they may be smart enough to send us pictures, coded messages with very simple mathematical formulas in them, just to establish the rudiments of communication, and then we can go from there. Remember, for us as scientists, just the notion that they're out there, even if we can't interpret the message, just the existence of a message is one of the greatest moments in the history of science.
Let me open the phone lines. There are many of you, of course, who are fascinated by the whole prospect of, well, what Andy Fracknoy, I think, appropriately called one of the greatest discoveries, potentially the greatest discoveries of mankind, humankind, womankind. Feel free to join us. In fact, let me give you the toll-free number. We're talking about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, astrobiology, exobiology. There are many names under which this is often categorized. But what it means is there's a possibility that there is, as they used to say on the TV show, something out there, and we can detect it, and they can maybe even detect us and make contact. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. And you can join us now. You can also join us, of course, by email. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. Or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And we're talking also about the Allen Array of Telescopes, which is very important to the whole SETI project and to the whole search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and right now in hibernation because of budget problems and funding, and that has many people who want this search to go on, especially because of the Kepler discoveries, to continue and particularly to be funded. Let me go back to you, Tom Pearson, because there's a lot of data that's come out of the Allen telescope. It needs to be analyzed, doesn't it?
Well, there's two parts to my answer to your question. Our primary SETI search using the Allen telescope array is intended to be a real-time or essentially very near real-time data processing effort so that if a candidate signal is discovered, you would know that within something like 5 or so minutes of that observation and be able to redirect the antenna back to that frequency band on that particular target. So that is one way in which we conduct SETI with the Allen Array. We have also been using each Friday for a number of months to store data for use in our new SETI Quest program, which is continuing even while the array is closed. And the SETI Quest program is putting stored data out on the internet for high-end mathematical geeks, if you will, to apply their own algorithms to and see if they turn up something there.
There are many who listen to this program. You might as well give out your website if
yeah,
they want to
thank you very
avail
much,
themselves
yeah.
of that.
Sure, thank you very much. You can go to www.seti.org and learn about anything I'm going to say today. I'm pretty sure will be covered on our website. And as I was saying, we do store
you want to get
data.
The community more involved, especially maybe the gaming community.
Absolutely, that's a new part of our SETI Quest effort that we put out to introduce a gaming contest to allow that community to help us think through better ways to tackle this question. Because after all, we're looking for the weakest signal and the biggest batch of data you can possibly imagine, and we need all of the people helping us that we can.
Andy Fragner.
Well, I wanted to just set the background a little bit because I don't know if many of our listeners know how amazing this entire array is in terms of what it can do. And I like to compare it to television watching. When you watch TV, you often flip between the channels. And now with cable, we have all these channels. Well, that's the game that we have to play. We don't know what the channel is that the aliens prefer. And there are many, many, many channels. You know this from your own radio dial, and that's just a tiny part of what's possible in the radio. So the big step forward in the whole SETI effort in the last couple of decades has been the building of special devices that can listen to millions and billions of channels at the same time. So imagine if you had a robot device in your home, it scanned every TV channel on cable and told you if anything good was on. This is the equivalent of what the SETI Institute is now doing. We are searching, eventually the ATA, the Alan Telescope Array, can search 8 billion channels at the same time and essentially ring a bell for the scientists if some signal exists on one or more of those specific channels.
So what do you say to, I read one of your fellow astronomers, Ben Zuckerman, who is part of the Astronomy Society of the Pacific, and he says, well, if there was some civilization out there, we would have heard by now, or they would have gotten in touch. He favors what he says is a more pessimistic view because there haven't been any visits here that we know of, and I mean, depending on who you talk to, there are those conventions that when we used to talk to Andy, when Andy was a member of the Bay Area Skeptic Society, we used to talk about those ufologists and those people who feel that we have been visited. But let's say at this point there's no proof positive. Zuckerman takes the view that maybe we're kind of whistling in the dark here.
Well, I've known Ben for a number of years, and in fact, Ben conducted some SETI experiments early in his career, and he's come to a conclusion that possibly is correct, and that is that even though there may be other civilizations out there in our galaxy, they are so few and far between, and the timing problem between when they might be broadcasting and taking into account the distance and the time travel of their signals compared to the time when we might be listening is such that it's an almost overwhelming task. So he has become a pessimist. Yet on the Quest show here on KQED, I noticed that Ben did answer a question. So is it worth the $2.5 million a year to keep the Allen Telescope Array going? And he said, absolutely. He hopes the donors step in and help it happen. So even as a pessimist, he thinks it's worth doing the research to see if he can get an answer.
He's a pessimist, but maybe he's had the Kool-Aid.
right.
And Martin Rees, the astronomer royal, once said that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And I think that's a wonderful phrase. When Tom said a little while ago that it really is like there's an ocean of possibility. We haven't checked most stars. We haven't checked most channels. We haven't checked most ways of looking at the signal. And we don't know when they feel like broadcasting. Maybe they only broadcast every other Tuesday, and we don't happen to be pointing at their star that time. So when you look at all that, it's literally like we've taken one glass of water out of an ocean of possibility. It's way too early to throw in the towel.
Let's bring our callers into this, and we'll begin with a caller from North Carolina. Daniel, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering, with the candidate planet that you were discussing earlier, assuming that there was anything there that could receive our communication, how long would we be talking between sending a message from us to even the how would they decipher it, and then their time to respond.
Can we quantify that? How long it would take to get a message if we made contact?
Well, it's absolutely dependent on how far away the source of that message is. And astronomers count towards that question in terms of light years, which is the distance light travels in a year. The nearest star to our own is a little over 4 light years away, Alpha Centauri. And so even at our nearest star, it would take 4 years to get here. And stars at the far edge of our galaxy would take 100,000 years to get here in terms of when the signal starts versus when it arrives on our radio dish.
Yeah, in fact,
it's a long time, even if it were just every other Tuesday, Andy.
That's right. And the idea here is that nobody in their right mind would just say hello, wait 100 years, have them say hello, and go back and forth like that. The minute we know they exist, you would set up a stream of information in both directions so that while we're waiting and adjusting, we can at least be sending them some information about us, and they could be sending information about themselves. So
everybody has that image, at least I think if they saw Spielberg's movie Close Encounters, you know, of lights being sent back and forth, of all of this kind of communication, because like you said, there's no language necessarily. And even if a civilization does have language, it's alien language. It's not any language we could speak in. Do you think if there was a way to communicate that, let's say you could do it visually, is there some way to send images visually in that sense?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the first things that Frank Drake thought of when he began to map out how we would make this communication is to send images in the form of dots, very much like the dots of light and dark that make up the pictures in the newspaper or on your computer screen. We could send a raster, we could send a box of dots, some brighter, some dimmer, and they would make up a picture. And on that picture, for example, we could have what we look like, we could have information about the location of the Earth in the solar system, basic astronomical things that would help them figure out who we are. And we're hoping they do the same thing. They will send us a simple picturegram before any kind of language gets involved.
Let me bring another caller on here from Tucson. Bob, welcome. You're on.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Excellent program. Just a question. A receiving sending dish, Arecibo, was on the original SETI program. Is that still in effect as well? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, we thank you for the question. Tom Pearson.
The Arecibo radio dish is funded by the National Science Foundation and is still on the air. It is used by astronomers from around the world. It's a major international facility. Our SETI program is no longer at Arecibo because we have now constructed the Allen Telescope Array for full-time SETI observations. However, the University of California, Berkeley's Space Sciences Lab does still have the SETI at Home data collection instrument at Arecibo. That is not a real-time observation. It's recorded, and that data is sent out to people's computers around the world. So, yes, Arecibo is still involved in SETI as far as SETI at Home is going, but not as far as real-time SETI observations such as we did in the late 90s and early 2000s.
We're coming up on a break. You can join us. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. SETI, the Mountain View-based organization, has been scanning the skies for signs of alien life now for about 25 years. They're now searching for funding to continue their mission, particularly for the Allen Array of telescopes. Cutbacks in state and federal funding have forced the SETI Institute to shut down its array of listening devices, the Allen Telescope Array of dishes. And scientists say, as we've said on this program, the irony is they've been forced to turn off their electronic ears just when the Kepler satellite identified a number of planets that could harbor life. Andrew Fracknoy with us in studio is chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College. Tom Pearson is CEO and co-founder of SETI Institute. And getting a number of emails here about Stephen Hawking. Let me read them. Big headline, "Don't talk to aliens," warned Stephen Hawking. In a Discovery Channel documentary last year, Hawking said that alien life is almost certain to exist, but instead of seeking them out, humanity should be doing all it can to avoid any contact. Quote, We only have to look at ourselves to see how intelligent life might develop into something we wouldn't want to meet. I imagine they might exist in massive ships, having used up all the resources from their home planet. Such advanced aliens would perhaps become nomads, looking to conquer and colonize whatever planets they can reach, end of quote. He concludes that trying to make contact with alien races is a little too risky. He said, if aliens ever visit us, I think the outcome would be much as when Christopher Columbus first landed in America, which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans. And another listener, Greg, writes, Stephen Hawking is concerned that intelligent life has a drive to seek and consume new resources and that broadcasting our presence may open the earth for exploitation. So there you have two emails right off the top. Thoughts, Tom Pearson?
Well, Stephen is addressing the question of transmitting in that related to those questions. And the search for extraterrestrial intelligence as conducted by ourselves and by other scientists around the world is a listening program, not a transmitting program. There are no professional SETI programs involved in transmitting. But unfortunately, right now, the Earth is pretty noisy, including the broadcast radio signals going out for this program. They're announcing our presence. So there you go.
But well, if they want resources, they're going to have to go through the pledge drive to get them. Here's another listener, Andy from Oakland. Robert says, isn't it presumptuous to assume that intelligent life out there, as we know it, as your guest stated, will be like ours, oxygen-based, et cetera? Isn't it just as likely that life will be based on entirely different environments? Are we looking for life like ours because that is all we can imagine, or is it just a logical place to start? And also, can your guests answer the question, why do they feel we should look? It's an interesting but basic question for them to answer.
Wow. Well, I want to go back for a minute to the other question, which is I want to make the analogy of KQED Forum. When you listen to this program, you don't identify yourself. You have to call in to identify yourself. And that's the key crucial point about our program, which is passive SETI. We're not actively sending anything out. But you're absolutely right. And we are, in fact, not making any assumptions in the SETI program about what kind of biochemistry the aliens have. When we search for life on Mars, for example, we do make assumptions about what kind of chemistry we can search for in our laboratories. But when we listen for signals, we're just assuming technology. They could be the most slobberingly alien-looking things in the world, but if they have radio telescopes and they send messages, those messages will reach us. So we make far fewer assumptions in this radio listening program about what the aliens are like than we do when NASA sends a probe to another world.
Tom Pearson, here's a listener who says, SETI funding dilemma doesn't add up. Michael, news reports have focused on the inadequate government funding of the Allen Telescope Array, but the government famously got out of the SETI business in 1992, and other NASA astrobiology grants have been up and down. The SETI Institute has known for years it had to cultivate other sources of funding. So my question is, if SETI is so important, a world-famous scientific organization with stars like Jill Tarter and Frank Drake at the helm, why has it not been able to raise a measly $2 million a year to pay for the Allen Telescope Array? That's been their charge since 2004 when Paul Allen contributed millions to the project. Is it possible that the real problem is the Institute's own fundraising engine?
Well, sounds like a question that somebody who has really thought very carefully about who we are and what we do. Let me be precise about the funding that has been lost that was federal funding. It was not funding for SETI. It was funding for the Hat Creek Radio Observatory that the University of California, Berkeley, for many, many years had support for that observatory, and that was why we at the SETI Institute chose to partner with them. Unfortunately, that significant funding from NSF in days gone by has been reduced in recent years to a drop compared to what it was, roughly been reduced from $2 million a year to a couple of hundred thousand a year. And that's created the problem for the sustainability of the observatory. And so, yes, we at the SETI Institute are going to endeavor to raise the funds to replace that funding that was there, as well as funding that used to come to UC through the state of California. And as we all know, the state of California is suffering financial problems. So, yes, we need to get busy and raise money to run the observatory at Hat Creek. That was not on our budget until last month, and we are going to undertake to make it so.
Andrew Fracknoy, Spencer writes, can the array detect emissions from weather on other planets, and would that shed light on whether a planet might have a hospitable environment?
No, that's not possible with the array. We're only looking for radio signals. But I should say that for the first time using the Hubble, we have been able to detect weather on some of the worlds that we found in other ways. There are planets orbiting other stars where as they go around their star, we see the starlight come through the atmosphere of the planet. And that tells us what the atmospheres of other worlds are made of. This is brand new stuff that's just been possible in the last year or two. But we are actually now able to tell what gases are in the atmospheres of some of these alien planets.
Every time you come on the air, there's new stuff to report. I mean, absolutely. Astronomy is moving forward. Let's move forward and get some more calls on here. Tim, thanks for waiting. Join us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks. I'm a big fan of your program. Yeah, a quick question about, you know, receiving radio signals from, you know, hundreds of thousands of light years away. Is it possible to, you know, use wormholes or other kind of science fiction type theories to have more real-time communication if we find a intelligent life form?
Well, this is a complex issue. Wormholes are this idea that there are places, for example, like black holes that twist the very fabric of space and time, and that if you could travel through them, you would emerge elsewhere or elsewhen faster than the speed of light. There's some theoretical possibilities here, but there's no practical value for sending messages. We have to respect the limits of the speed of light. That's the fastest signal in the universe as we know it.
And I thank the caller and move on to Neil, calling us from San Francisco. Hi, Neil.
How are you doing? I'm a fan of the
program. I'm sorry?
I have a question for you.
I think we have a bad connection here. We're going to have you call back. Let me go to Berkeley. John, you're on.
Hi, Michael. I wondered if your guests, what they thought of or if they've thought of the fact that our five senses might not be able to perceive alien senses and vice versa. They might have senses that we can't conceive of, and they might be right next to us, right next to you in your studio, and you can't sense them.
Are you implying that one of my guests is an extraterrestrial?
No, I apologize for that.
Well, no need to apologize. It might be an advanced civilization, but have you contemplated this whole question, Tom Pearson?
Well, yes. I would say that that's been a topic of thought for SETI scientists ever since the 1960s when SETI began. The problem, though, I think can be summarized in the fact that we as humans can only use an approach or a technology that we understand. If there is something that we have not yet invented or we can't perceive, we don't know how to look for it or how to detect it. Technology marches onward. Perhaps someday we'll have different sensors than we have today. But I do think in today's world we're applying the best possible sensors that we can.
And I thank the caller and go to more of your emails. This is from Jim in Fort Collins, Colorado, who says, the more the data is compressed, the more it looks like noise. If alien intelligences are mainly transmitting compressed data, how will we be able to distinguish it from natural radio noise?
Well, so this is actually part of the most exciting work I think that Jill Tarter and her team are doing in looking at this vast ocean of possibility. We're not just looking at what telescopes to use and what stars to look at, but how to massage this incredible flood of data that's coming at us from the universe. And Jill's team, with some wonderful help from people in software development and, as Tom said, mathematical nerds around the world, and particularly here in the Bay Area, has been figuring out really clever ways to distinguish the data from the noise, to find in the vast static of the universe little indications of what might be a very gentle message hiding there among the noise. And the techniques are getting better and better, and part of this whole SETI Quest project that Tom brought about is to get the sort of the universe of programmers and others involved in how to massage the data to find the messages that might be hiding.
Well, here are some of the naysayers. We'll get these out here. This is Dave, who says, this is one very expensive science fiction fantasy. Adult nerds should buy their own toys. And here's another listener who says, considering the economic challenges we're facing on Earth, example, feeding everyone, caring for the elderly, funding infrastructure, why should we continue to fund SETI search now? Those are sort of the two poles that you get in the way of resistance to the admittedly small modicum of, in the grand scheme of funding that SETI gets. What do you say, Tom Pearson?
Well, first I would say that everyone involved in SETI are also human beings living on this planet, and we ourselves see the myriad of problems that we as humans face. I can confidently say to a person, everyone in our program donates to other programs, and we care very much about social causes. But I do also believe that humans have always been explorers. Since the earliest recorded history, there's evidence that mankind looked at the skies and wondered what is out there. And I think it's all of us involved in our research believe that it's worth that small investment in comparison to the overall economic budget of our country, as an example. It's worth the tiny investment that we ask our donors to support us in to carry out this this exploration so that we can try to determine, does life exist beyond planet Earth?
You have something to add here, Andy Frank?
I would. I think I've been on the board of the Institute for 25 years. It's my favorite thing to be on. And the reason is that I'd like to be alive when we discover whether or not we're unique. I mean, think about the impact that Columbus's voyage, for example, had on our view. Think of the impact that our picture of the Earth from the moon had on our self-image and the beginning of Earth awareness.
We have never since talked about something called a new world, but we would again, presumably,
that's right,
at this discovery.
And the notion that is so deeply ingrained in us of our uniqueness is something that is really a philosophical dilemma in a way.
Need to be more humble, like to have a smiley set
right
in the last
That's
hour.
That's right. Exactly. What if we found that there was other life out there? Wouldn't it change our picture of ourselves in profound ways? Wouldn't it be something that was food for thought way beyond most things that we discover? So I don't think that this is merely a search that science fans are interested in. I think we would all be affected if we succeed.
Let me put in a plug here, by the way. If you want more coverage of SETI, KQED's Quest series, you can find it. Just visit kqed.org/forum and click on that particular segment. Here's something all my years in radio I didn't know, and I don't know. This is one of our listeners, Bruce, who writes in and says, Nikola Tesla thought he was receiving alien radio communications when he detected the signals from a pulsar. That's true.
Not from a pulsar, from the Nikola Tesla and actually several other people, Marconi as well, in the early days of using radio communication, found that when they pointed their telescope, their antennas up, there was noise coming, and they were convinced that they were either getting Mars signals or some other kind of intelligent signals. It turned out to be whistlers, absolutely natural phenomena in the upper atmosphere of the Earth. But for a while, there were headlines that we detected radio waves from Mars. Uh-huh. This was a first wave, if you will, of SETI before we kind of knew what we were doing.
Never knew that. All the histories of radio, somehow that never cropped up. And air cropping up is a caller from Santa Rosa. Art, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I just tuned in a little bit late. I'm curious if anybody has asked you yet questions about Area 51 and all these other things I see in the computer from time to time, interviews with aliens and so forth. I'm a big skeptic of all that stuff, but I just wanted to get some input from you folks, what you felt about this top-secret area in Nevada, and I can...
Well, you can read all about it in the Inquirer or the Examiner tabloids,
That's so right. And I think for here, it's a very simple question for astronomers and scientists. We would love it if aliens came to Earth and made our job so much easier. Who would be happier than scientists, right? At the same time, we need evidence. It's amazing that all these sightings and these secret landings, and we don't have a single piece of physical evidence, not a sandwich left over, not a fender that fell off, no piece of evidence we could take into the lab. None of the kidnappees have any alien thread in them, any surgical thread. So until we get something physical that we can test, we have to be skeptical about these reports. A lot of them have to do with psychological logical needs of the intelligent beings on Earth rather than anything about intelligent beings in space.
Let me just remind you, if you'd like to join us in the time remaining, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can also join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. You're going to add something here, Tom Pearson?
Well, I was just going to say that Area 51 is obviously a classified government research site, but it has nothing to do with aliens. It has to do with, over the years, it's had a lot to do with the development of things like the stealth aircraft that the U.S. military uses today and other such things that—
Including quite possibly those helicopters that went to the compound in Pakistan.
We don't know because we're not supposed to know, but yes, it could be.
There's a listener who says, I took a class with Professor Fracknoy at Foothill. I really enjoyed his classes and found them— Wait a minute. English teacher in me took a class and enjoyed the classes. Okay, never mind. And found them both enjoyable and informative. About SETI, is it possible to put the SETI program on ice for a few years while new methods of scanning and analysis are invented? Could the SETI search be put on hold until funding is more available, more planets have been found, and the means of radio observation are more efficient?
Well, this is Tom. I would say that, sure, it's possible. We hope not to... to face that situation because we have the tools and we can do the work right now and we can also be prepared for doing the work better in the future.
I don't know. And I guess I would say our dream is that, although the previous listeners talked about how much money it really is in the cosmic scheme of things, a very small amount of money that we need. And we're here in the middle of Silicon Valley. And I kind of wanted to mention that really we're in the middle of the search industry. I mean, a lot of the search engine development has taken place in Silicon Valley. And just, I don't know.
Why wouldn't Silicon Valley take this on more?
Yeah, I have this dream that someone like Google or Yahoo would say, the search, that's our specialty. Let's take it on. So maybe someone from Google is listening right now, and maybe they can take that on as a small project. I mean, it would seem to be so ideal to go with the idea of searching data to talk about searching for data from other civilizations.
Well, we'll take on some more of our callers, and we'll go to Palo Alto. Michael, join us. You're on.
Yes. Well, my name is Michael Williams, and I was a student of Andrew Fracknoy's at Foothill College last quarter, and I had a question that I've been meaning to ask in class and forgot, but my question is in regards to confidentiality. If a signal was ever found and that signal was considered to be from an alien source, would confidentiality be retained? In other words, would the public ever be notified? And would there be some kind of a danger in notifying the public of a signal? How would that affect the masses?
Just think of Orson Welles. Yeah, Tom Pearson.
Well, I hate to jump in front of Andy since you were his student and he may want to add something here, but In fact, it would be almost impossible to keep the detection of a signal confidential and out of the public's eye. And the reason for that is if our SETI signal detection systems do turn up a positive answer, we cannot accept that positive answer without getting confirmation from another observatory somewhere else on planet Earth. You can think of our instrumentation as the world's largest fishnet to find a signal. If we ever find a signal, that fish out there in our net, then we know the right angle, the declination, and the frequency from which that signal is originating, and we can ask any of a number of observatories around the world to look specifically at that signal and see if they also detect it. That's required before we actually have confidence in our signal. Otherwise, we could have a software glitch or a graduate student introducing a funny bug in our system. I think my answer, plain and simple, is it wouldn't be possible to keep it confidential. But Andy, maybe.
Well, I think if I can, again, speak for the Institute, there is actually a protocol that people have developed that says that this signal will be the heritage of all humankind, that it is not something which any scientist has the right to keep to him or herself. We will have to make some hard decisions as a planet, as a people, about answering. I think answering is a much more complex issue than just listening. But the fact that the signal exists will take the best minds of humanity, because it may be hard to decode. It may be that it will take years to figure out what's in the message, and we want everyone to get to work on it right away. So I think sharing it openly is very much the policy of the Institute and the right thing to do.
And Tom Pearson.
And on top of that, we have promised our donors, first and foremost, Mr. Paul Allen, who's mm-hmm. made the array possible, that we'll let him know immediately. And likewise, we would let all of our donors know.
So that Microsoft can start processing.
Well, if you've read Paul's book, he's not affiliated with Microsoft anymore.
Yeah.
Here's David, who writes on our website, SETI is the whole reason that I am going to school to earn an astronomy degree. Are we alone is one of humanity's oldest questions. We are on the verge of solving that question, possibly opening up new fields of study. We don't know if we are alone or not unless a systematic search of the skies is made. Underfunding SETI searches is extremely short-sighted. And another listener says, what if there are transmissions in some technology unknown to us? Is it arrogant to believe we have the only or the best technology? Well, I think the answer to that is obvious. Of course it is. I've been speculating on that for a long time now. And just want to remind listeners that you are listening to Forum. We're talking to Andrew Fracknoy, who is chair of the astronomy program at Foothill College, and Tom Pearson, who is CEO and co-founder of the SETI Institute. And well, this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. On we go. More of your calls. Michael, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. First time I've called in. I listen to the show frequently every morning before I go to my classes.
Appreciate that.
So I had two questions. My first question was, element would they believe would be the next common building block for alien life? You know, if it wasn't carbon-based, what would it be? Would it be silicon or some other element? My second question was, what kind of parameters do the SETI Institute use to determine what life is, as far as when they're searching for it, or how they would recognize what something living would be?
Andrew Franklin.
So there are a couple of things to say about that. First of all, carbon wins hands down, unfortunately. Carbon is the go-getter of elements. It's really...
It's also the footprint we're also worried about, isn't
it? That's right. But in terms of making connections with other atoms, carbon is very good. So there's speculation of other elements like silicon that might be the basis of life. But again, we don't make any assumptions about that, nor do we make any assumptions about what kind of... other civilization it might be. All we want is the product, which is a radio signal. And it's not only that, there's also other ways of searching. For example, we've been looking for very intense light signals. Frank Drake has a whole program to search for intense pulses of light that might compete with the stars very briefly. Or we might look for the heat from a civilization that has surrounded its star with a giant shell for energy collection. So there are many ways that we can get evidence that there are aliens out there.
I keep thinking sometimes it's all heat, no light, though. I mean, what we're really looking for is light here, or some way to light up this whole question that has been imponderable since time immemorial. Are we going to add something, Tom Pearson?
Yeah, Michael, I'd like to address the second question of the listener. At the SETI Institute in our Carl Sagan Center, we have astrobiologists looking at life in extreme environments here on Earth, essentially from pole to pole, from Antarctica to the Arctic, in some of the most acidic volcanic vents, and basically trying to understand all of the different ways that life exists right here on our planet. And those understandings, as conducted by the research by our scientists and others around the world, are getting broader and broader in terms of how life exists right here on Earth. And that's how we're going about trying to understand how life might exist elsewhere.
Speaking about life existing elsewhere, there is a school of thought that says we need to plumb the depths of our ocean much more. We know very little once you get down to certain regions of the ocean or a certain depth in the ocean. And there's life down there. There are organisms down there. Some of them have been found to be actually scientifically useful in one way or another with the environment. Why not go down rather than go up?
Why not do both?
Well,
why not? I mean, because, for example,
with limited funds, though, you do get to these questions.
Well, but we have a moon around Jupiter called Europa, which looks like it may have an ocean, and studying the life forms that can exist without sunlight, deep, deep at the bottom of the ocean floor on Earth, is an incredible step toward trying to understand whether there might be life possible deep inside the oceans of Europa. So we're trying to cover all the bases to find life that is unlike us, life that is like us, life that is intelligent, life that is just starting. Any one of those discoveries of a second genesis, of a second start to life that wasn't here on Earth, is going to be, I think, a radical step.
And whenever I have programs like this, I always get the emails about, we have to find more intelligent life on this Earth, or there's not enough intelligent life, all those bad jokes. But let me go to another caller. Tom, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I just had a quick question regarding the kind of information we'd be looking for in the transmissions. I read somewhere a while back that if we were to transmit ourselves, we would probably be sending like prime numbers, something very simple. So I wonder if either of you guys could shed some light on the information we're actually looking for.
And Andrew Frechner.
So there's a variety of ways of coding and decoding information. I mean, that's what we do here at KQED, right? The sound of our voice is coded in and then decoded at the other end in your radio set and turned back into sound. So one of the ways in which we're thinking very hard about this is how to make a message that would register in someone else's radio telescope. We've been fashioning our own sample messages. There are many ways of doing this. One thing would be, for example, to have a message that will repeat information on a regular basis. Another might be, as the caller mentioned, to have a mathematical system where it's not the blips, the number of blips that you get, even if you can't figure them out, is in some sort of pattern that's not natural static, but has an organization to it. Frankly, we don't know all the ways that aliens might code information into these messages, and that's why algorithms of various kinds are being developed.
Well, the search will go on, and for more coverage of SETI from KQED's Quest series, just visit kqed.org/forum and click on the segment. Thank you so much, Andy Frechner. Thank you, Tom Pearson. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
This hour of Forum. And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We also want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, and welcome back, Amy Machado. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.